Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by Winamp. Subscribe to TWiT and all your favorite podcasts with the ultimate media player. Download it for free at winamp.com. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 256, recorded July 11th, 2010. The Shirtless Page Turn. This Week in Tech is brought to you by GoToAssist Express. If you're in tech support, save time and money by supporting your clients and colleagues remotely with GoToAssist Express. For a free 30-day trial, visit GoToAssist.com/TWiT. And by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to publish a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 10% off your new account, go to Squarespace.com/TWiT. And by Audible.com. Sign up for the Platinum Plan and get 2 free books. Go to audible.com/twit2 and follow Audible on Twitter. User ID audible_com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, the show that covers technology news. We bring on some of the best minds in the tech community, the journalistic community, to talk about the week's tech news. And we have a great panel this week. I'm really glad to have Joshua Topolsky back. He is the editor-in-chief of Engadget magazine.
Hey,
hi, Josh.
How are you?
Good to have you back.
Good to be back.
Also with us, Mr. Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle. We've been trying to get Dwight on all summer, but he's just got a busy schedule.
Traveling man. I'm back, but I'm here. I'm ready. Let's party.
Let's party. Blogs.cron.com/techblog. And lo and behold, long time no see, Mr. Will Harris, who is rapidly coming up to be the number two most often used.
Oh no, I've got a while to catch Patrick, I think.
Oh, well, Will, we love having Will on. He hasn't been on in a while, from channelflip.com and the UK. And you're on because this is Soccer Sunday all over the world.
Yeah, baby.
We won't give you any spoilers.
Like, you're like Alec Baldwin on Saturday Night Live, right? Steve Martin has the most hosts, and then
Alec Baldwin. Second.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm trying my best.
Almost as good looking.
Oh,
that hurts. That's got to hurt.
Ooh.
Ooh. Well, who can forget Alec Baldwin's Skype performance in It's Complicated? It's burned into my brain, that's for sure. You remember? You probably didn't see it. It's a chick flick. I got dragged there by my wife, and then I had to see it again in Blu-ray.
He had to buy it and see it again.
Yeah, I had to. He is flirting with Meryl Streep. They have a Skype call going on. Meryl Streep has a Skype call going on with Steve Martin. And they're having a little thing, but her ex-husband, Alex Baldwin, decides to sneak into her bed naked, doesn't realize the Skype is there. Steve Martin comes back to Skype. He left for a while, and there's a big, fat, naked Alec Baldwin on Skype. It's a great moment for Skype, I think.
Big, fat, sexy.
It makes you want to Skype.
Thank you, Leo. Now I don't have to go and see that film.
Spoiler alert!
Yeah, you're ruining the World Cup.
We will not say who won the World Cup, although somebody has won the World Cup. We will not, I promise, blow the vuvuzela anytime soon or anytime in the show.
It was a team.
It was a European team. So even though England didn't make it to the end, I think that there must be some happiness in the Northern Hemisphere, right?
Well, it was nice to have an all-European final.
Yeah.
That was nuts.
England's not in Europe, is it?
Well, technically we are, yes.
You're in the EU.
We are a member of the European Union.
But geographically.
There's something about the British kind of, you know, character that doesn't quite gel with the sort of European, I don't know.
No Galois. Sort
of yeah, exactly. It's just, you know, we're a little bit less refined, I think.
Is that it?
Than the rest of Europe.
Is that it?
We're a little bit more blunt.
But geographically, maybe. Leo, I think they are geographically part of Europe.
Are they? I always thought that Europe was not everything but England. And then there's the UK.
Well, there's some people in England who'd be very happy with that. But strictly speaking, yes, we are all Europeans.
I don't know. This is not what the show is all about. God knows. One of the reasons I'm glad Joshua is here, because one of the things this show has been about for the last few weeks is smartphones. In fact, in many ways, technology talk these days is more about smartphones than it is about computers. And it is about we don't talk about netbooks or PCs or desktops or laptops. We talk about smartphones.
I get complaints on my blog.
That's where the innovation is happening.
Yeah, exactly. You get complaints?
I get complaints from kind of old school readers who say, this is a tech blog. You should be talking about Windows.
we just got a complaint today like that. We get those all the time.
What? You're in Gadget. In Gadget. Gadget.
I know. We're trying to cover gadgets, you know? How dare we cover the hot new gadget?
I always thought, actually, gadget was kind of a pejorative, kind of a diminutive phrase. And I never liked doing, whenever I do mainstream, and I stopped doing that pretty much, television, they always wanted gadgets. We want to see gadgets. Like, that was not as scary to people as talking, or boring mostly, as talking about a technology, about computers, about the internet was. But gadgets isn't really appropriate when you talk about a smartphone that has more power than your computer did 5 years ago.
Well, I mean, it's, what was a gadget? Something you might have because it's cool or fun to use, or, you're a complete nerd. Now it's everybody has one and they're much more powerful. So, I mean, I feel like it still applies. I think there's something about a smartphone that is almost like the perfect, it's the perfect gadget. It is the ultimate gadget. I think that's why we cover them so much. So I feel like it weirdly works really well with when it comes to smartphones.
And
like,
you have to think about, when you look back to what our sort of, early, mid, late 90s definitions of gadgets were, the sort of James Bond stuff. And smartphones really are that.
They are, aren't they?
Video conferencing everywhere. It's the equivalent of the old, the video screen on your watch or whatever, where you're talking to somebody. Who can say that FaceTime isn't exactly that?
Right.
Knowing exactly where you are at any point in the world, and how to get to anywhere else. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
It's the book.
A nutshell.
All it needs is a button that says don't panic and you're set.
Mine has don't panic right there.
Does it on yours?
I think we're at the point with gadgets or smartphones that we were with PCs, say, in the late 90s, and that the best is yet to come, and that these are, we're in that same growth period that happened when Windows was, about to be on every desktop. The Mac was dying, unfortunately, at the time. And I think that it is that what we're going to see in the next 10 years is just going to blow our minds compared to what we have right now.
I have to agree. I have to say, I think that the innovation we're seeing in the mobile space right now is just unbelievable. I mean, it's unbridled. It's like the brakes have been taken off and we have this whole new space to explore, this entirely new platform, really, where you can do a lot of things you could never do with a computer. And I think the reason why we cover it so much and the reason why we're talking about it so much is that the amount of technological innovation that's happening in the smartphone space is unparalleled, except maybe when you look at the PC race, when it really got going, when people really started figuring out, hey, you can get these things in your home. Look at all of the stuff you can do with them. I think there's some big ones, PCs, internet, and I think this mobile space, the mobile internet, smart devices is just barely tapped at this point.
Let me get a little philosophical on you. Do you think the rate of innovation is constant? In other words, the human condition is such that we will innovate, but what happens is our attention shifts from platform to platform. So then now that the PC platform is mature, and really we've seen it, both Windows 7 and OS 10 Snow Leopard, there's not a lot you can do new. Both of these were refinements of an existing OS. Maybe our attention is now shifting to a platform where there is more scope for innovation. Do you think that's the case, that it's just kind of a constant? We just are looking for an outlet, and this is what the smartphone has become?
Well, I think there's a a degree to which the innovation has been driven by hardware or the lack of hardware innovation. I mean, the sort of PC massive race that we talked to, you know, we were just talking about was when, you know, Intel was constantly making new chips. The gigahertz were going from 200 megahertz to 1 gigahertz to 2 gigahertz to 3 gigahertz to beyond to multi-core, dual-core, all these kind of things. And that's kind of tapered off now. You know, we haven't seen a processor, you know, ever hit 4 gigahertz.
We won't get
commercially
to
released
nope,
from Intel.
We're done. Yeah.
So what we've seen now is that all the, you know, the innovation in the hardware is now moving into the mobile space. Things like the A4 chip, which suddenly allow you to start really accelerating that pace of change in the mobile space as well. And so I think, although there's definitely an element of, you know, we're sort of choosing to move between spaces, I think there's a good degree of, you know, it's dictated by what the hardware guys can actually make happen.
The traditional, conventional wisdom is that hardware outpaces software. So that you get a lot of innovation in hardware, and then software is kind of slow to catch up and take advantage of it. Are we in that, Dwight, you think that we're in that situation now with smartphones, that the hardware is outpacing what the software is capable of?
I would say definitely, with one exception, and that is that because Apple is controlling both the hardware and the software, I think that maybe within that space and on that particular platform, you know, you may have a neck and neck situation.
Well, but you can see, like, the Retina display. I mean, as good as it is, when I look at stuff on my iPhone 4, very few apps are yet taking advantage of the Retina display.
Well, they just released it. You got to give them time.
I'm in a hurry. Come on now.
But
at what point do you say hardware is ahead of it? I mean, you're already starting to see apps that do take advantage of the better display. The reading apps look much better for those that have done it. It's not that hard to do. The libraries are in the software development kit that Apple releases. So on Android, I think you have more of an opportunity to kind of have catch up for the software, because it's almost all independent. Google gives you the libraries. It gives you the design. But ultimately, it's going to be up to the developers to see if they can make the potential of it. I think Apple delivers more of the potential faster.
You know, I think that, but this touches on something that is has been an issue in the desktop and laptop space, which is a real lack of innovation in that software. I mean, it seems like people hit a point and they said, this is what a desktop environment is going to be like, and we're good with this. Let's not innovate anymore. I mean, you have to think about OS X. It's built on Unix. You know, Windows has been Windows for ages, and you've got Linux, and Linux is built on Unix really as well. I mean, it's a very similar concept. So you've got two of the big ones built on basically the same thing. You've got Windows, which hasn't changed and arguably hasn't changed drastically in, 15 years or 10 years. So there's not a lot of innovation happening. And I don't know if that's just because people have become comfortable with what's available or there aren't any good ideas out there. But what's interesting is you're starting to see the mobile space sort of loop back around and impact the desktop and laptop space. So we're getting used to all this touch input, all this gesture-based stuff, and that's starting to creep into how we interact with our laptops and our desktops. And I think that'll hopefully spur some of that innovation.
I wouldn't be surprised if you don't see in the next version of the Mac OS that it looks a lot like the iOS based off the iPad.
There are rumors that Apple may even abandon OS X and kind of start doing an iOS.
I think there's probably at least one more release of OS X out there.
I have to admit that I keep touching my screen on my laptop. I've come to the expectation that I can manipulate it with my bare hands.
Isn't that the future? Not comfortable. To reach out do this.
Yeah.
On a
desktop, it's not. But on a laptop, it's a little more intimate. I could do that on a laptop.
It's still if you use the iPad in the dock or with the wireless, the Bluetooth keyboard, and it's in the case, and when you have to do something on the screen that you would normally do with a mouse,
you want to reach for a mouse.
Reach up and touch it.
Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of weird.
It's kind of irritating.
That's kind of weird. But that's what I'm saying, Dwight. I think that's because we're dinosaurs. We're used to the mouse and keyboard. I think if a generation grows up with touchscreen devices, whether it's the iPad or something else, they're going to get used to that. I think that in many ways may be the form factor of the future.
Non-dinosaurs on the panel think so?
Yeah. Well, it's just you and me, John.
I actually think the iPad doesn't go far enough. I mean, I was pretty disappointed, and I remain sort of underwhelmed by what Apple did in the iPad OS. I think, you know, it's basically iOS through and through. There's nothing that really feels like it's made for the iPad in that version of iOS. So I think that Apple could go further. And I think that, you know, what you're saying about it, you know, is the tablet going to be what the laptop becomes? You know, I think it probably will be. They just have to come up with a much more intuitive and comfortable way to use it. I mean, I think the iPad is okay, but I don't think that you can just slap the iPhone OS on
right. A
larger tablet and make it.
Do you think we'll have all of them, all of the above? You'll have a touch screen, you'll have a mouse. I mean, that there are some PCs with that form factor. You'll have a trackpad. You'll have one of those nipple devices on the keyboard. You'll have a head-mounted sensor.
I think the nipples are well gone there.
I hope so. Let's hope so.
Surely, yeah. It's time to ditch the nipple.
You'll have Microsoft Kinect. In fact, I think Microsoft is implying that Kinect will make it into Windows 8.
They talked about using sort of motion.
Yeah.
Based
My sense from that slide, that leaked slide of Windows 8, is that it would have all of the above.
Oh, you know, Microsoft, they always have lofty goals. And,
yeah.
You know, they have a huge R&D department. I mean, you'd be blown away.
And how much
they
actually make it in.
Right.
Like the courier. Remember how awesome that looked?
Yeah.
And they work on stuff like that 24 hours a day. And then you see.
Well, even the file system. Do you remember the sort of debacle of the file system for Windows Vista?
Longhorn. They were going to do this Longhorn WinFS.
The revolutionary new system that they did the whole thing and then they just canned it.
And now they're talking about Windows 8 and there's no mention at all of any change in the file system. Still NTFS.
And they've got the cloud. What is their cloud OS?
Azure.
That's right. And is that going to be tied into 8 or is that just an experiment?
Who the hell knows what that is? Yeah. It's going to be tied to Ray Ozzie's ankle for the rest of his life is what's going to be.
But I mean,
well, I could see easily if, you know, we talked about the idea of it not being comfortable reaching up and touching your screen. But if you were reading on a notebook computer or on a desktop and you want to turn the page and you just do this in the air.
It's
that's
natural.
That's very natural. Or, you know, to do like this and to not have to reach up, that's, I think that I would like that.
Let's talk about one of the forces that's going to impede all of this, and we really got to do something about, which is patents. And there are two patents that were in the news this week that really do impact that. One is Microsoft says we're going to apply for a patent for the page curl, the turn where you see the page and you see the back of the page and you see the front of the next page as it turns over. First of all, let's get rid of that, please. But apparently Microsoft thinks it's important enough to patent it. I guess why not patent it? Do you think the page turn has much life in it? Do you guys like it? I turn it off immediately.
I do like the page turn. I think it's a... You know, I found that when I started using iBooks, I realized I did something with books that I wasn't even aware of, which is when I'm reading, I'll kind of curl the edge of the page while I'm reading just as a weird little tick. And I notice myself doing it a little bit when I read in iBooks, which is maybe disturbing or weird.
What do you mean? You hold your finger in the corner and kind of slowly...
I just kind of run my fingers along the pages on the side, you know, and I'm usually shirtless, you know, that's the image of that.
Okay, TMI.
Very sexy stuff.
Thank God it doesn't have a camera.
But yeah, not yet. I think we need some of that humanness in the design. I think Apple understands that better than almost anybody. It's let's add the thing that maybe is superfluous, but also makes it feel a little bit more human and tangible and real. So, I like the page turn. Is it patentable? That doesn't make sense.
Well, you could patent the process involved in making it happen in software.
Yeah, the code.
The code is patentable.
But surely so much prior art.
I don't know, in terms of
other people have done this before, haven't they?
Well, yeah. I'm sure that
HyperCard
probably had it.
It does seem it's a little late in the game for patenting the page turn.
There's two things you can do on the iPad with it. I don't know how well this will show up, but you can do the page turn like this.
Right. We saw
that.
Or
you can also, if you don't want the page turn, you can just tap it.
Right.
And it.
No,
you
still got a page turn there.
You still have kind of a look to it.
Yeah.
And this is the Kindle app.
See, I turn that off. There's a basic page turn in the Kindle you could turn on in the settings that just you tap it and it slides. You don't get that thing. I turn that off.
You hate the page turn.
I don't hate it, but it's like, why waste the time? I know I'm turning the page.
You're so busy. You're like, I can't wait
for
the
page. There's no physical. But anyway, you know, I actually think that I understand why initially when new technologies come along, you make them look like the analog world. But at some point, that is kind of a little concrete, and you could probably let go of that.
But it feels to me like Apple is.
It's like having a mouse pointer look like a hand. Remember in the early days of the mouse, it was a hand. Like that made you feel better.
Click a link, right?
Yeah, when you it's still in browsers. So
yeah, that's right.
I mean, it seems to me like Apple is just trying to make this stuff more accessible. Right, they're just trying to make it more familiar and less like it's this scary digital thing and more like it's an experience you can relate to. It's like the whole desktop metaphor. We could have left the desktop metaphor a long time ago.
Yeah, we didn't, though, have we? Yeah, they're probably, in
but
fact,
we haven't, because it's familiar.
It's probably holding us back, though. There's probably a better way.
Familiar.
Yeah.
Well, but books have, I mean, come on, they've been around a while. Books have really made their mark. Don't you think so?
But by being bound to this notion that what you have is a stack of dead tree material that you're turning, it binds you to a concept of your serial data that isn't required by the form, and so I think it limits the form, and it means
I don't know.
I mean, I have to get out of that mindset, too, where I'm also in that box. But I'm thinking, for instance, and I'm sure you'll see this, that books no longer are static text on a physical page. For instance, why do we turn a page at all? Why don't I just scroll up? Why do I need a page? What's this page have anything to do with anything? It was because we couldn't make an infinite scroll of paper. So get rid of it.
But well, you know, when you look at on a web page and a long, long, long scroll, people don't like that.
That's true. They want a page. Break. No, you're right.
And I think there's a mental break that you have to make.
Yeah, you're right.
With the page. And also, Apple is about making things comfortable, warm, and fuzzy. You know, there's that one of the slides that they've done. They did this both at the iPhone 4 announcement and the iPad announcement. The intersection of liberal arts and technology.
Yeah, I actually like that.
Exactly speaks to that.
They love that sign.
But I like that.
It makes sense.
I made sense.
I think some forms need limitations. I think that they don't necessarily, you shouldn't say, well, let's just blow apart the concept of a book. You know, look, why do I need words in a book? Why can't it just be a sound or something?
Well, it might be.
It's like, I think that, well, yeah, but I think that, you know, you get people who say, well, every word should hot link out to something else and there should be all sorts of contextual stuff going on. And there is something that is valuable in the isolated, straightforward experience of book reading. And so the page turning, you know, things separated by pages, and that even that animation which ties into it isn't necessarily I don't think it's necessarily evil, or it should be exercised. You know, I think that there's some value to the isolated, straightforward experience of reading a book.
Another patent
totally insane, though,
applied for by Amazon could hurt Barnes & Noble. It's the patent, and could have hurt the Courier. Maybe this is why Microsoft killed the Courier. It was a patent on dual-screen technology. What exactly, Dwight, was it that they were claiming?
They're looking at, right now, the Nook has this has two screens on it. The Nook is
which
Barnes & Noble.
Which is, by the way, its chief advantage. It has a color strip. Running Android, well, I think.
Yes.
Yes, right. It's running Android.
Underneath
it may be an advantage depending on what you think of the performance, which is not necessarily zippy.
No.
But essentially, you control page turns and you control other things by touching the screen down below. The screen up above is like the Kindle. It's a static or non-touch screen e-ink display. And so if you have the ability to kind of control it down here, the theory is it's a little more friendly. I don't know. I haven't read the details of the details of the Microsoft patent, but obviously, you know, they could come to Barnes & Noble and say, hey, you know.
Well, there's two patents, actually. There's a Microsoft dual display patent that they filed. We reported on June 30th, and then Amazon was granted a patent for a dual screen e-book reader. So I don't know if there's any interplay there. I don't think there is.
I wonder if this was the reason the Courier was killed, because that's exactly what Courier was, right?
I don't think I think the Courier was killed because Microsoft couldn't get it together. Right. I don't think they weren't like, hey, Amazon might do it.
Oh my God, they could patent it.
I think that it was 100% Microsoft if they killed the Courier. But you know, these dual display devices, I mean, actually the Nook, you know, you mentioned the performance. I noticed with the update, the performance is a lot better, but I still think it's sort of a failed experience to have that little display down below and then the display up top. And we've seen other devices, the Edge, something called the Entourage Edge, which has two screens. One is LCD and one is e-ink. Also kind of an uneven experience. I think like anything, what really makes this stuff work is a great user interface and a great user experience. And a lot of these companies forget, in the excitement of, hey, we can put two screens on this thing, they forget we also need to make an experience for the user really great. So,
there. That's all there is to say about that.
Everybody's just like, I did not.
No, you said the definitive final word.
That is the final word.
There was nothing more to say.
Sorry.
Well, actually, I have one question for Joshua.
Okay.
To beat this dead horse. Have you played with the Sony touchscreen reader? I haven't played with that. What is that like to you?
No, I haven't. I have not played around with it. I did play with the, what is this? The Q reader, which is it's not out yet, but it has a touchscreen overlaid on
the expensive.
Yeah, the Plastic Logic. Mm-hmm. It's great. It's just the UI is actually really beautiful and it's elegant. It's just, you know, the response time of e-ink is painful to experience. So
Bing search shares up 7% in June. Google down 1%. Now, 1% doesn't sound like much, but I was told at one point, I think Jason Calacanis told me that 1% of search is worth like $1 billion. So it's a significant shift.
Yeah, but if you have $90 billion, you probably won't miss one.
One. What's one?
Right? You have $99 billion.
What I can't work out is if Google lost one and Microsoft gained seven, who lost six?
Yahoo.
Alta Vista.
Ask.com. I don't know.
Ask Jeeves.
Ask Jeeves.
Jeeves.
I think I wish we had more search competition.
You're right. I mean, we need it, and I think we're going to.
Google has been bad lately.
We're going to see it because I think that I think Google knows this very well, that the idea of searching an index of pages is not what people want is rapidly becoming obvious, which is why Google's adding real time search. Why they bought this? What is it? IAT, the airline guide. Because people don't just want search. This is why I think why Bing might be gaining some traction. The whole premise of Bing was, hey, it's not just search. We'll help you buy tickets. We'll help you find the right flight. And Google's now started to say, yeah, if you do a Google search where you say, I have 7 hours and $1,000 to spend, where can I go? We'll be able to give you the answer now. Like somebody would actually search for that. I don't know who would
want
to
do that. You're not like, I just... Seven hours, $1,000. Where am I going?
Tell me where to go, Google. But isn't it true we're getting past to the kind of search that Google is so good at to something else? I don't know what, but
well, I think there's a lot of people who are saying that the idea of search being trawling lots of information that you have kind of no stake in or no interest in.
That's what those crazy
is kind of done.
Have you
and
seen?
The new search is effectively recommendation. I mean, if you want to search for a great restaurant to go to dinner, do you want to search Google or do you want to ask all your friends on Facebook?
Have you seen? You Facebook probably haven't seen these in Britain. These Microsoft Bing commercials. Have you seen those?
Oh, the decision thing where all the people go crazy.
They're
about
crazy. It's they call it search overload syndrome, and they grab you because they're so bizarre. At first, here I'll play one of them just to give you, since you're stuck in the great UK where you can't see these fine commercials.
I think these do air.
We really
in the
need
UK,
to find a new place for breakfast.
The Breakfast Club, a 1986 cult classic starring members of the Brat Pack.
What?
So, do we want an LCD or plasma?
Plasma is an ionized gas.
Next time, we gotta find cheaper tickets.
Cheapskates. Cheap thrills.
I'm having this back pain.
Backpacking back to school? Johann Sebastian Bach.
Seriously, we need a new place to eat.
Let eat my dog.
These people seem like Stepford wives. They seem so strange.
They're in a Microsoft Google is turning commercial. Us all into confused robots.
Robots. Artificial intelligence. Machines. I am robot.
I mean, don't you feel like Google search has gotten? I mean, there's
why is
so
it
much
bad,
noise.
Joshua? What's wrong with it? It's too much noise.
Dude, there's so much noise on the internet. I mean, here's what the internet has now become, right? It just feels like to me when I search for something, it isn't like, hey, I went and found this thing that I needed. It's let me sift through this enormous amount of noise to try to find the one piece of usable data that I really wanted to get at. I feel like the state of search. This whole SEO race has destroyed our ability to find and use real information. I think that we have a flood of scraper sites, a flood of associated contents with, millions of articles. I mean, the other day I was looking for something. I found an article that was a review of deodorant. It was literally a 1,000-word human being wrote a review of a $4 tube of men's deodorant.
And what were you searching for, Joshua?
I was searching for deodorant reviews, but I mean, I was searching for like an alcohol-free deodorant or something. But you know, but the fact of the matter
is, wait a minute, though, Joshua, that's the strength of the internet. If you happen to be looking for a review of deodorant, somebody's written it.
I was saying I wasn't actually looking for a review of deodorant. I was looking for something else. I just happened to cross this thing, and I said, "I got to see this." It was like Javon Musk deodorant.
It's probably
review.
That was probably Demand Media, right? Something like that.
It was Associated Content.
Yeah, there you go. That's the company Yahoo bought.
The whole this desire for everybody to make money off of search results has really polluted our search results. Yes. You know, it really is just has it's another way to spam people. You know, if you don't get the spam email for Viagra, you get the spam search results for Viagra. And so it's like, I don't know. I think there's a real problem. I'm not saying Bing solves the problem. They may just be adding.
I think this is why, you know, Facebook has attributed to it so much value, because the potential is that you can start to get all the information that you want. You know, you can get your deodorant reviews, but you can get it from trusted sources within your social network. You don't have to go outside of that network to people that you don't know or don't want to know, or, you know, to spammers to get that kind of thing. I mean, that's why ultimately people think Facebook is, or why Google is so worried about Facebook, because there's, you know, as Facebook gets bigger and as your social circle gets bigger, you know, potentially there's no, you know, 90% of questions that you're going to want to know can be answered by someone in your social network without having to ever go to Google, potentially.
You know, we had Nicholas Negroponte on the Engadget show, and he had written previously about 15 years ago about this system of looking at news, and you would have a little slider that you'd be able to go to the left and to the right, to, depending on what news you were going to see, if it was conservative or liberal. You would literally slide this thing. And I said, who's going to be the editor of that? Who would be the person
the
in
arbiter.
Control and said, yeah. And he said, now this is exactly what we're talking about. Now that person is your friends, your circle of trusted people who you're getting, you know, you're being able to sift through their picks.
I think that's very powerful.
I think it is as well. I mean, it's certainly better than a robot. I think an algorithm can't figure everything out. You know, an algorithm, you have to get to a point where you say, it's like, didn't we just hear about Google News starting to use human editors to sort through?
There was tech meme that changed to human editors, I think it was.
Well, Google News is doing it too.
Are they really?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
So I think what people are finding out is that when it comes to things that are really important, like medical information or news or things where you really need to get, or even less important, like a restaurant review or something, now there's so much out there, so much content, it isn't enough to just say, well, the good stuff will bubble to the top, the bad stuff will bubble down to the bottom. Because you can game it. You know, if you can game it, then you end up with bad information. You end up with skewed results. And so the human being is really that barrier between the game and the person on the receiving end.
Well, that's what people like Matt Cutts, who works at Google, fighting spam. That's exactly – Google has many, many people working on exactly that, trying to sift out
the
SEO.
Is, you know, what people define as spam is different. You know, Josh is saying, you know, this sort of – really kind of cruddy, you know, content from sort of content machines like Associated Content, you know, is basically the modern equivalent of, or the search equivalent of spam. And, you know, for Google, that's kind of a legitimate business that feeds money back to them via AdWords. So it's, you know, who defines what spam is in that sense?
Well, that's so, okay, that's why your social graph is so useful here, because your friends presumably know what spam is. That's why I think Kevin's doing Dig 4. I think that's the whole idea of Dig 4, is you find the news that your friends tell you about. He's a little late to the game, though. This is why people love Twitter, isn't it? And I guess why they pay attention to Facebook.
And this is also why Google is reportedly working on its own social network that will obviously incorporate its own search. And, you know, once you apply Google search, which is very, you know, works well when it finds what you're really looking for, to a social network like that it would run itself with your trusted sources, that could be pretty powerful. And I think Facebook probably should be a little nervous about that.
We're going to go ahead, Joshua, but in a second, we're going to take a break. So go ahead and final words on this.
I was just going to say that, you know, we seem to have decided, actually, I don't know who decided this, that making money off of ads was the only way to make the internet profitable for businesses. And we have just sort of locked into that idea. You know, Jaron Lanier wrote a book called You Are Not a Gadget, which touches on this quite a bit. I don't know if you've read it, but the idea that we have decided advertising is the only way to make money off of our content online. And of course, I speak as a person who makes money off of advertising. That's what Engadget does. But I think it's we need to explore some of those other ideas about ways you can, you know, because you don't want to get into that cycle of spam, basically, because it's easy to game that ad system.
We're going to take a break and come back with more. Actually, Google has made a move, apparently, that is going to help it with this imaginary Facebook clone by going directly to one of Facebook's biggest contributors and investing in it. We'll talk about that in just a second. Before we do, though, I want to mention our friends at Citrix, the creators of the great GoTo Assist and GoTo Assist Express. GoTo Assist Express is something that we started using in this, let's see, I guess 10 years ago almost, on the screensavers to help people with their computer problems. We'd be able to get into their computers and fix it. Well, it's better and easier and more effective than ever before, faster too. The new GoTo Assist Express, you could try it free at GoToAssist.com/twit. Here's the idea. You know, whether it's a family member or you're in an IT department, you've got to support your users, or maybe you have some software you support. You got somebody with a problem. They're across country. They're around the world. Maybe they're just even down the hall, but you don't want to get up from your desk. You want to solve the problem, not on the phone, but by reaching into their computer and fixing it. That's what GoTo Assist Express is so good at. They don't even have to have the software installed. Just tell them, go to Assist Express. Here's the code, and they enter it in. 20 seconds later, you're in their system fixing it. Or you can send them a link. But the first step is for you to install it free for 30 days. GoToAssist.com/twit. Up to 8 sessions at once. Sessions can be unattended if your users let you do that. You get a complete assay of what software is running on their system, security software, operating systems, background software. You can drag and drop files from one computer, your computer, to theirs. So if you've got a patch or a install, you can just move it over. And that's where those eight sessions at once really come in handy, because you've got an install going on one. You don't have to sit around, you know, waiting, playing Doom. Does anybody still play Doom? No. Only our sysadmin. You can go to the second one or the third one or the fourth one, up to 8 sessions at the same time. I use it with my family. It's so great. They do have day passes if you don't do assist, you know, support all the time. But if you are a regular support professional, you're going to want to get the monthly. Very, very effective, very affordable. 128-bit encrypted, so they can use it in an open access spot without fear. 24/7 support for you. GoToAssist.com/twit. Give it a try. Absolutely free for 30 days. It's just fantastic. So TechCrunch had this story, and you know, I'm always a little suspicious when I first see TechCrunch, but then VentureBeat confirmed it, that Google has put $100 million into Zynga, the creators of Farmville and Mafia Wars. Zynga's apparently raised $500 million this year, which sounds like a lot until you realize they're well on their way to making $1 billion a year selling bits to people who are farming, in big air quotes, on their Facebook page. I guess it's a good investment. It wasn't the venture arm, though. It was Google itself that put $100 million into Zynga. I guess it's a good investment, but it does sound like they're preparing the launch of Google Me. And, in fact, this rumor on it may even be that they're, and this is what GamesBeat said, that they're going to do a Google Games as part of this new social platform. Does that make sense, Dwight? Oh, Dwight, I can't hear a thing you're saying. Unmute your thief.
Right. If you, I think it does. If you look at how addictive all these games are, everything from Farmville and, you know, the various games that are on Facebook,
Mafia Wars,
all this. I think that casual gaming,
than casual gaming, this is virtual goods.
Virtual goods and really addictive gameplay.
Yeah.
I don't think it necessarily has to be virtual goods. My wife is a serious Words with Friends addict.
Me too. I got 7 games going now.
Right, right. And she, you know, what was funny was we would go out to dinner and she'd, give me grief for looking at my email, and now I get to give her grief for her playing Words with Friends.
Stop playing Scrabble!
But the addictive nature of this, Google has already said that, and to get back to our first discussion of the night, Google has already said that everything is going to be mobile first. And so I would not be surprised if you don't see this launch with a mobile platform as well as that platform.
Well, I was going to say this seems like it would tie into, I mean, potentially if there is this Google Games thing, you know, there's going to be, if Chrome OS exists eventually, which they say it's going to, there's going to be an application store for it. Or in their case, it's not really an application store because everything is web-based.
A website store.
So it's like something like Farmville makes perfect sense because it is online. You know, it's something you play inside of a browser for the most part. I just don't understand where people are finding all the, maybe it's just me, who has time to play these games? There's so many people playing them.
But that's the strength of it, Joshua. It takes a second here or there. It's not like you're playing a very long, elaborate game. If you've
I don't
got,
even get those seconds.
Well, you're working too hard. Stop working so hard. No, you can always, you know, there's always a time when you're sitting waiting for a phone call or you're in line somewhere where you can play a quick game of Scrabble, you know, not game, quick move. In Scrabble, you know? I mean, you're sitting here, you're looking at your board, and you say, oh, I got to make a move. And I think these are very compelling. I play a number of these casual games, and there's something about playing it socially that really makes it fun.
Question about people keep saying Google Meet, or that's what their social service is going to be called, the social networking.
Supposedly, yeah.
Google,
yeah.
What about Orkut? What happened to that?
Have you used Orkut?
It's still part of their you know, offerings. I'm just saying.
I tried.
You know, when in Brazil.
Yeah. When I quit Facebook, I said, everybody, let's go to Orkut. And I went there and I went, oh, never mind.
Yeah.
It's just not it's not a great experience.
The other thing to keep in mind is that Apple has announced it as part of iOS 4. It hadn't shown up yet. This Gaming Central feature.
Right.
That will let you find other players online. I suspect that Google is so intensely competitive with Apple right now, that may be a part of this as well. It would allow them to do that on Android so that it stays competitive with iOS.
This is depressing me just looking at this.
Yeah, this is my Orkut page.
What are you updating? Is this you updating your status here?
Yeah, there's my status. Look at that. There's the wall. Wow. You know, it doesn't
looks like
look...
Buzz.
This is like looking to, this is the beta for Google Me.
Yeah, might be.
You use, Leo, you're a Buzz user, right?
I love Buzz, yeah.
I mean, Buzz is, to me, isn't that a failed Google experiment? I mean,
I disagree. I don't think so. I mean, what does Google need for it to be a success?
People need to use it more than Twitter.
So that's not going to happen.
Or instead of Twitter. How about that?
I don't think Google, I think that's the question. Does Google Me have to be used more than Facebook to succeed? No. I think it just does Google Docs have to be Microsoft Office to succeed?
Sure. Surely the point of Google Me is exactly that it needs to be not necessarily more popular, but the default social platform in order, if we all sort of agree that search is going more social and social recommendation, then for Google to stay the leader in search, it needs to become the leader in social.
Well, that's a tough row to hoe.
I agree with that. I think that if you're going to make a play for that space, if you're going to go to say we're going to start a social networking service, I don't think you're doing it to be complementary to Facebook. I mean, I highly doubt it. Google has to go all in and get that demographic over to their service because it's easier, it's more integrated, it's more fun. I don't know, but I think that if you get you have to play to win in that space. I don't see any other way to do, just like a light social networking light for Google doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
What do you make of the reports that Eric Schmidt and Mark Zuckerberg had a little private tete-a-tete at the Alamo?
Was that before or after Mark was served?
Two really awkward people.
Yeah, really.
Talking.
I would love to see
a really awkward conversation.
I would love to see the body language analysis of that one.
Yeah. I don't know. What were they supposed to have spoken about? Just like Eric was like, it's like, I'm going to take you down.
No,
Zuckerberg
I've been to the Bohemian Grove. When you get these big shots together, they just talk about BS. How's the wife? How's the kids? You know, they don't. What are they going to say? And they'll dance around the fact, but they're in there. You know, they don't compete face to face. They're not competing face. They're not going.
Do you really think that at the fabled Steve Jobs, Eric Schmidt, Starbucks meeting that they talked about the wife and kids?
They didn't talk about nothing. That was a photo op.
Photo op.
That was a total PR move.
I don't think that's true.
Of course it was.
I don't know. They were casually. They just went out to their regular coffee place.
Sat in public, waited for people to show up, get some pictures, then went back inside.
And what did he say? They're going to see it anyway, so they might as well. Really mysterious.
Yeah, which, by the way, still makes no sense.
Yeah.
Or maybe it does.
We don't have any proof that that was staged, though, do we?
No, but I think it was pretty clearly staged, don't you think?
It's just a weird why.
Yeah, right.
Do you know why they staged it?
Yes, I'll tell you why. Because Apple, there's been all really of this ink going on about how Apple and Google are at loggerheads, and that's not good for either company internally to start thinking there's this rivalry. We got to get Apple. We got to get Google.
Work for Microsoft and...
And Lotus?
Well, no, with that, I mean, you know, the whole rivalry, the Apple, you know, the Apple when Microsoft rivalry was effective in for both of them, actually, when you think about it. And really, you see Apple kind of reaping the benefits of that fanaticism now. Yeah.
I think a certain amount of that is good. And clearly, Steve thought so, too, because when he spoke to that all hands meeting, he did kind of rev up the rhetoric. I think what happened was, right after that, he thought, "This is getting a little out of hand. Let's look a little more collegial." Eric used to be on our board. We do still use a lot of Google stuff on our phones.
What about the Bing move? That's a gauntlet thrown down there, if you ask me.
Well, did it happen?
Bing is on the an option.
It's not the default. If it were the
but when you go to Bing, when you go to Bing on the iPhone, and this happens on Yahoo as well, when you go to Bing on the iPhone. And you do a search there. When you complete the search, it says, "Do you want to make Bing your default on the iPhone?" Yahoo's been doing that for a while, but this is the first time that Bing has done that.
I mean, the fact that it's on there at all, I mean, this is Microsoft we're talking about. I mean, this is the enemy, right? I mean, if there's an enemy here, really, I know they've collaborated and blah, blah, they're buddies. And, you know, but the truth is, if you think Steve Jobs is psyched about Microsoft, you know, you're crazy. So I think it's interesting that they put Bing on there, that they went that far. I mean, it's not essential. Bing isn't essential to the life of the internet right now, but Jobs thought there was some good reason. I feel like that was a sign, that was a signal to, kind of a signal to Google to say, you know, look, we don't need you. I mean, we could move away from you. Just keep in mind there are other things out there.
Absolutely.
It wasn't like iPhone users were saying, oh my God, I got to have Bing on my iPhone. You know, that was not
definitely not.
But businesses
and nations need enemies.
We don't know. Yes, that's true. But we don't really know. It may be that Microsoft said, well, we'll give you a check for $500 million if you put it on. I mean, we don't
know. Okay, Steve Jobs needs the money.
I don't think Steve's the kind of guy who's going to walk away from money.
How much cash do they have on hand? It's something ridiculous amount, right?
30 or 40 billion or something like that.
They just need to buy a few other companies in cash. That's no problem.
All right. So is Google really going to do a Google Meet, and do they have a shot at taking on Facebook?
Is it going to be done Wave style? Buzz and Wave style?
Okay, Wave's a flop. I think we can all agree that. I think Buzz has, you know, here's the thing. I think Google has some aces up its sleeve that it hasn't played yet that aren't going to be much use much longer, so they're going to have to play them pretty soon that have to do with search. For instance, Google Me will be clearly tied to Google Profiles, as Buzz is tied to Gmail. I think you can tie them all together if you use your search kind of creatively. For instance, if you make sure that if you search for Joshua Topolsky, what shows up at the top of the search is his profile. By the way, Profiles and Buzz are the same tab of one page. And then maybe there's a Me tab. If that's the first thing you find when you search for Joshua Topolsky, doesn't that suddenly become a very powerful platform?
What if Joshua Topolsky, who is your friend, has already searched for something similar, found what he's looking for, and favorited those, and then you come back?
That's
and
built
say,
in.
Oh, yeah.
They already do have that feature.
Right, right. So the other thing, you know, the thing about Buzz is a new friend feed. It looks like Friend Feed. It acts like Friend Feed, which ironically was bought by Facebook.
I know.
And
by the way, I use it instead of Friend Feed now to do the same things I was doing with Friend Feed.
Right. I really think, and somebody record this, put it on the internet.
That, being recorded.
I hope
that,
so.
That this is a mobile play, and that Facebook has, you know, does limited stuff with mobile. Google is going to do a serious mobile social network.
The failure, the only thing really that Buzz is the reason you would say Buzz is a failure right now is because they were slow to come out with a third-party API. It's still fairly new. So remember, it took Twitter a year before anybody even heard of it.
I think there's an intrinsic problem with Buzz that they, right out of the gate, I really wish had not occurred. I mean, which is the connection to your Gmail account. I mean, first off,
they made
I
a mistake
hosted,
there.
As my main mistake. Email, I use a hosted Gmail account, so I don't automatically don't have Buzz in the place where I really live in terms of email. Second, it is attached to a profile that I don't want it to be attached to. It's part of a system that I don't want it to be a part of. Now, if Google Me existed and you said Google Me and Buzz are companion products, they live together, but they don't live inside your email. They don't live, you know, in your analytics or whatever other Google services you're using, fine. I think their biggest mistake here was not saying this is a standalone product. We're going to use our resources. You can connect it to your email account if you want, but it's a standalone product. You can have a separate account here. I mean, one of the big things that, Google's doing now that I find rather annoying is the desire to connect each part of your Google experience with the same account. So now when I log into YouTube, for instance, it wants me to connect YouTube to my Gmail account, to another account, so that I can log in with that. And that is not necessarily something that I want or need to do. And I feel like the idea of the unified login, the one login for everything, is not only dangerous, but it's actually a little bit annoying when it comes to separating the different parts of your life. You know, I may want to use YouTube for personal projects. I don't want it to be connected to my work email. I may want to use Buzz for talking to my friends, and I don't want that connected to my work email. I mean, I think there's just a lot of problems with their premise. The idea that you want these things to live together, the Buzz living inside of my inbox is actually awful. I mean, I think it's an awful idea.
Well, I mean, that's really interesting because I think what they're trying to do in that sense is build, you know, what I feel is kind of like the 70% use case scenario, where probably you are, you know, in a sort of 30% band where you're sort of hardcore power users. You've got a hosted Gmail thing, your own Gmail thing. You've got different profiles. You know, you're probably uploading stuff to multiple YouTube accounts, all this kind of thing. And the unified login is a nightmare because actually, for you to be able to distinguish all these separate parts of your online life is really crucial. For most people, the ability to just sign into anything using the same Gmail or Facebook account, whether it's, you know, Amazon or, you know, Netflix or anything like that, a unified login would just be like a massive hassle saver. And so I think what Google is trying to do is build sort of a
security risk.
Well, yeah, it's right? Trying to build
something
for most people.
It's a tough position for Google because they want to leverage what they've got. But you're right. That's Joshua. That's going to piss off people.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I like the idea of being able to log in a lot of places with one thing. I'm not saying that the premise of that is a bad idea. I'm saying I wasn't given a choice when it came to Buzz. If I could log in,
I think you're right. I think they made a mistake. I think they made a mistake. Yeah, they made a mistake.
Just give me the choice, and then I'll decide after. You know, it's like, I think Steve talked about this at D8, and obviously it was a big conversation there about the opt-in or opt-out. It's like, don't make it opt-out. Make it opt-in. Give me the power to start with and then go from there. I think it's frustrating when you have a company like Google, which has so much access to so much of your personal information. And I'm not a big paranoid guy. Like, I'm not worried about what they have access to for the most part. I don't think they really are going to abuse it. I mean, because look, their motto is don't be evil. So how could they possibly
how could they be evil?
So I think that you got to give people the choice first and then let them make the decision.
Do you think they have learned lessons that they'll apply to Google Me, or, you know, is the temptation to use kind of the expansive nature of what they've got already such that they will make that same mistake again? I mean, it's very tempting, you know, to pull together everything.
It was a real mess. I mean, they really got some flack for what they did with Buzz. They have to have gotten it that, you know, this is not the right way to proceed. You know, with Google, it's weird. I feel like a lot of times the stuff they do isn't because they're trying to be evil or malicious. It's because they have this mentality where they say, let's just do it. Let's try this out. This seems like a good idea. We'll see if it works or not. Everything's very beta. It's a beta mentality. You know, they're sort of tweaking and changing and experimenting. They probably thought they made this decision in a fairly arbitrary way. Somebody probably said, hey, this makes sense to me. Let's do it like that. And a few other people said, okay, we agree. I'm not sure that they had maybe they had a strategy, but if somebody had known this was a potential, that the backlash would be so strong, they wouldn't have done it.
Yeah,
I think they should have known better.
Yeah, maybe. But we assume they're perfect. They're not perfect. They're just a company.
Well, they're very engineer-driven, sort of that's very engineer-driven.
They're not normal humans. Go ahead.
Well, and you also sort of assume that these people have got sort of all these experiences before. I mean, the idea of, you know, the massive amount of privacy needed in the online world has really only come around in the last, you know, couple of years as things have gotten more personal and more privacy invading. And I don't think there's really a sort of an offline precedent beyond sort of, you know, your government papers or your hospital records or something where you're so keen to do something in what is, you know, effectively a public forum but still maintain your privacy. And I think that although in many ways, you know, what the rules should be are relatively obvious, I think there are many cases where it's just not that obvious and people are making mistakes because nobody's done this before.
You know what's interesting? Google, Apple, Microsoft, Facebook, all of the big players, the four horsemen of the internet, if you want to use John Doerr's terms, have made some pretty big blunders of late. You could see all of them kind of stumbling. It isn't.
It's because they're moving so fast.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing to do, and it's not immediately apparent what people really want. And I'm sure Facebook thought that it acted in good faith to do exactly what people were looking for and was probably a little shocked when the response was so negative. I'm sure Google didn't plan for buzz to be such a hot button for people.
Is this a case of geeks and millennials? Is this a situation where...
Well, that might be true, too, that the market's very fragmented, that there is no one user.
There is no one user, and that the people who are developing these things are younger. They're engineers. You know, I hear from people who work in the design areas at Google who express frustration privately about the idea of everything being engineering driven and that, UI doesn't get much of a feel and possibly even just simple rules of etiquette don't get much of a hearing in Google's products. And so I think if you look at kind of the engineering mentality, kind of a younger group of people for whom, you know, what do I have to hide? I privacy is not that big of an issue for me. And then you put it out there and the masses get it and they go, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. And I think that may be the case. I think maybe they need a more diversity of development and design. And culture.
Design. They do suffer on the design side.
Design Google. It's where Apple is so good at design. Google is so bad at design.
I mean, they're such engineers when it comes to even their logo. I've always thought the Google logo just is so not designed at all. You know, it's like somebody came up with it one day. They're like, well, you need a logo for this thing. Let's just have Joe, you know, put it together.
Just keep it clean, man. Just keep it simple.
Make it simple, whatever. You know, they arbitrarily picked a few colors.
I think you're right.
I do feel like they have this design thing where it's not even about, you know, it's not about function. Form following function. It's in the computing space. I think they have to be on the same form and function have to be on the same level. And in many ways, they're the same thing.
Right.
Form is function.
Absolutely.
When it comes to
and
how
they know
interact.
That at Apple, they know that.
Right.
At Apple.
They sure do. Yeah.
And it sings in their products. You can see in the iPhone. You look at the iPhone OS from start to finish is an experience that is fluid and natural and feels complete. And you look at Android. I mean, it's taken a year or 2 years just to get up to snuff, really, to any kind of fit and finish. And it's still very, it feels disjointed, you know? And I think that they need to start putting an emphasis on that. If they want to move into an OS space, you know, with Chrome OS, and if they want to really convince people that Android phones are the way to move, the path of the future, they have to convince people not just on the functionality, which is great, but on the form as well.
Yeah, you know, they remind me a little bit of Microsoft and of Windows in the early decades where they were in the same situation where you weren't really controlling the hardware. You had a lot of different hardware designers putting their own spit and polish on the Microsoft operating system. Microsoft was not a very good, well-designed platform. I think you could say it was fairly ugly. XP comes to mind as one of the ugliest operating systems I've ever seen.
It is.
So
utilitarian, very utilitarian.
Hey, I think XP's start menu looks a lot like the Google logo. I mean, I don't think there's
that. There you go.
I mean, the colors.
Yeah. So we've been here before.
And Microsoft is starting to get it. And when you look at Windows 7 and you look
it's
at
slick.
Kind of
you know how they got there though? They copied Apple.
Right. And look at like Windows Phone 7, for instance, is a completely, I mean, a kind of a breathtaking design departure for them. And it's really striking. You know, and I think it'll work. I think it'll be good. But it's like nothing that we've seen in the mobile space. Right. It's totally different. For
except
Microsoft,
for Zoom.
Well, it's a Zoom. Zoom.
Except for Zoom. But the Zoom HD, which obviously is a branch off of the main trunk of this design language. But, you know, I think that there's an old clip of an interview with Steve Jobs where he's talking about Microsoft.
Yeah.
And you know what I'm talking about, yes. Right? Where he's talking about their... He's like, you know, they're not, they don't make bad products. He's like, they just have bad taste. And he's talking about the way fonts are spaced and just really specific design stuff. And you know that he feels just totally turned off by what Microsoft does in the design space, which is not a lot, right? That back then, this was in the late
90s. Well, and that was the famous, moment from the D conference, right? Where Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were on stage, and Bill Gates was asked, "What's the thing that you most wished you had?" And he said, "Steve Jobs' sense of taste."
So he admitted it.
Yeah,
I don't have.
Taste. And it's an amazing video. And
talk about engineering-driven companies. Wasn't Microsoft the original engineering-driven company?
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah,
and that's what Google. I mean, Google's a little different, right? They have a little. I think Microsoft is very managerial. You know, they had a lot of hierarchy, right? So it had to, and you see in products like the Kin, you get the impression and you hear all these stories. It's still that way. It goes through all of these steps and rigorous sort of managerial levels. Google seems to be much more like the spokes are somewhat independent. They're sort of doing their own thing. People are allowed to experiment and push experiments out into the world in a much freer way. So you get a lot of innovation there, but there is that same kind of lack of aesthetic that was happening at Microsoft throughout the 90s, at least.
Let's take a break. We're going to come back and talk more with our great panel, Joshua Topolsky from Engadget.com, Dwight Silverman from the Houston Chronicle and the tech blog there. He also has a radio show, which I have been on in Houston, which is just awesome.
You were a great guest, Leo.
I love that show.
You're wonderful.
And you just celebrated an anniversary. What was the anniversary? The 15th?
The show is Technology Bites. It's on Wednesday nights on KPFT. You can listen to it on the web at kpft.org. It starts about 8 o'clock Central Time. It was our 15th anniversary.
That's amazing.
I haven't been with it 15 years. I've been with them since about 2003, I think. But yeah. We talked about the idea that when we first went on the air 15 years ago, we were talking about Windows 95.
That's right. When I first started in tech radio, Windows 3.0, DOS 5. So I beat him by a little bit, but not much.
A little bit.
Yeah, not much. Also, our good friend, longtime friend of the show, Will Harris from ChannelFlip.com. We'll get back to our conversation in just a bit. I hope you're enjoying it. By the way, you can follow along on our chat room, irc.twit.tv. Give us feedback. I watch it the whole show. I know some of our other panelists do. So it's a good way to kind of, as you're watching live, participate or watch live. We do the show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC at live.twit.tv. The chat room is irc.twit.tv. And we're glad to have you here. I want to mention right now our friends at Squarespace. We're glad to have them on board. One of our favorite sponsors. I just got an email from Dane Atkinson over there. Dane and Anthony and the gang do such great work. It's web hosting, but also the best content management system you've ever seen, for not just for blogs, but for websites of all kinds. They say it's the secret behind exceptional websites. And if you take a look at the examples right there at squarespace.com/twit, just click that examples link, you'll get an idea. There's, of course, blogs here. But there's also portfolios for photographers. It's so gorgeous. A lot of photographers like to use it. Businesses. Look, Don Imus just moved his page to squarespace.com. And you wouldn't know it's Squarespace. It's got that great Western look. This is the beauty of Squarespace. You start with templates that don't look templated, and then you have complete control. You don't have to be a designer. You just have to be able to drag and drop to modify these templates. Although if you do know CSS, And you are a web wizard, there's nothing you can't do. Squarespace gives you the capability of doing it all. But that's just the beginning. You can import your existing blog. It's got importers for all the major blog platforms. You can also do great post. You know, this iPhone app is incredible. Post from the iPhone. Statistics. Just it goes on and on. I want you to give it a try. Now, here's the deal. If you go to squarespace.com/twit, you can try it free for 14 days. You don't even need a credit card, so it's very easy to get involved. Just give it an eye, you know, a try to see if you like it. Squarespace.com/twit. It's built on Java, and they use a Java virtual server technology that gives you bandwidth no matter what. You know, they flip the switch. If you need more bandwidth, you got it. Sites start at $8 a month for the massive community site with all sorts of, you know, additional features, custom audiences, unlimited editors. Merely $50 a month, and that includes the hosting and the software and everything you need. But I'll tell you what, you're going to save 10% just by using the coupon code TWIT when you sign up. Squarespace.com/TWIT to try it free. If you decide to buy, 10% off for life if you use the coupon code TWIT. We really love them, and I know you will too. Squarespace.com/TWIT. We thank them so much for their support of our program of this week in tech. This is a story from the New York Times that you posted, Dwight, and I thought was very interesting. The cost of electronic gizmos may go up soon because of labor unrest in China, increasing costs in components, shortages, a big jump soon in how much these gadgets cost. We've been kind of living in a fool's paradise, haven't we? I mean, the cost of computing has gone down to the point where companies can barely, you know, you look at Dell's earnings, they may sell millions of computers, they can barely make any money on them. Maybe it's time the costs went up to reflect the real cost of this gear. What do you think, Joshua? You're one of the people who's dealing day in and day out with this stuff.
Yeah. Well, what if the quality went up with some of the stuff as well as the price? I mean, I think that it's become very easy to make things very cheap. And I think that there's a lot of cheap stuff. And I think that there's a lot of stuff made cheaply. Those aren't necessarily the same thing. I think there are conditions in China that we're starting to learn about, really, that we should be feeling more responsible for. I think that, and I don't mean us as just in the tech community, I mean people on the whole. I think that you have to realize that this stuff comes from somewhere. It's made by somebody. And if those places, if where that stuff is coming from, if the practices there are bad, if the people are being abused, if they're underpaid, if they're overworked, you know, you have to start thinking about it as a human being. You have to say, do I feel comfortable with this? Is this what I want in the world? Do I want people to feel that way?
Maybe we aren't paying enough. We're kind of living on the backs of workers who are being mistreated.
Cheap labor.
Cheap labor.
And the other thing is that I think the products themselves could stand to, you know, it's hard to say this because we report on this, but what about less crap and more really good stuff?
We talked about this last week. Dell sold 13 million computers with bad capacitors they knew about.
Right. I mean, let's get back to a point in the world where things you bought really were made with some level of quality and care.
No,
I think
that's not going to happen.
I think the one thing you can say about Apple, and I know that the haters will not like to hear this, but look, their stuff is made better than other people's stuff. I mean, you look at the devices. I mean, you have an iPhone 4 sitting there. Compare that to even the highest end Android device that's on the market
now.
And in my opinion, when it comes to build quality and materials, there's not a one-to-one comparison that I can find out there.
I think Apple is kind of very guilty of just occasionally pulling outrageous howlers and completely failing to admit it. You know, the number of first-gen MacBooks with, you know, fan flaws or, you know, that run desperately too hot, you know, the recent thing with the iPhone 4, although I definitely agree that, you know, when Apple gets it right, there is no, that, you know, they are peerless in the technology world.
There's some pretty serious flaws in this iPhone 4,
some
though.
Things, yeah, right.
My proximity sensor doesn't work properly. There's that antenna issue.
This is Apple or is this quality control? I mean, this is my question. You know, I've talked my Laura, my wife, writes for Engadget as well, so we talk about this stuff pretty much 24/7. And I've talked about it with the other editors. And my question is: look, these things were—they sold how many? 2 million in 3 days.
Yeah.
So there is a production line somewhere in China that was working at a pace. Yeah. They're probably still going at a pace that is completely insane. And this gets right back to the heart of this question. And Apple is talking about being guilty. Apple is as guilty as anyone of not doing as much, I think, as they could about the working conditions and the way that things sort of are run in China. But you have to imagine some of this is quality control. I have trouble believing, and I'm not defending them because I don't know the answer yet, but I have trouble believing that Apple let this device walk out of their testing with these major flaws, and they just said, well, it won't matter. We'll sell a bunch of them anyhow, and if people complain, that's not our problem. So I feel like there is a quality control issue with some of this stuff.
The yellow glue dots are probably a quality control thing.
That's a great example, right? Yeah, right. People are complaining about these yellow screen issue. It turns out, oh, the glue wasn't done drying.
Right.
Because they were rushed so quickly out of these plants in China that literally the glue had not dried. So, I mean, I think there's a question of that, but I agree with Will. I mean, there have been blunders, and they have every now and again, they've got something that is just like kind of unbelievable. How could you not catch this? But I do think the general build, I'm talking about the design and build quality. I do think it tends to be better than a lot of other CE companies. And I just wish that, I wish there was a way that we could find for all of the companies to really start concentrating on, hey, what are the materials? How is this made? What's the care that's taken to put it together? And not just say, oh, we can get a hard drive from over here and some RAM from over there. And there's these plastic cases that everybody uses. We'll just grab those too. And there's a computer. You know, and I feel like it just leads to an entropic state. And we see it, you know, it's sort of this lowest, you get down to the lowest common denominator, the cheapest thing you can possibly make. And the market is flooded with a lot of crap. Of course, I might be especially sensitive to this.
Yeah, you see more crap than right. normal. I mean,
we had to start doing a section called Crap Gadget, which is, you know, this USB.
I like it.
Like the USB.
The sushi USB
yeah,
keys.
Sushi yeah. thing or just like, you know, the USB rocket launcher, just whatever kind of. Yeah. I mean, that stuff is just sort of novelty, but you do right. get to a point where there's so much that people are churning out, and you're like, why does this exist? Did this need to exist?
Hey, by the way, just Dwight, don't say your wife's name on Words with Friends on the air. Apparently, I showed my name. Look at all the new games that I've been invited to participate in.
Oh, no, I won't. You know, Apple uses the same
Foxconn.
Yeah, right. They use the same manufacturers in Asia that the people who are making the crappy devices do. And, you know, and for example, they use a lot of the same components in the MacBooks and their desktops.
Sony used to make the laptops.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, why is it that Apple turns out a higher quality product using these same lines?
Well, I think you get the choice. In fact, yep. I bet you there's a little dial practically that you can turn and say, they
turn
say,
it up.
Okay, welcome to Foxconn.
They have a form or something.
Where would move the slider. Where do you
like, quality okay, I want good crap. Design. Get the guys, the more expensive guys on the
right.
production line.
Yeah, exactly.
To put these together.
I'm sure that's the case.
It's hard to say. How do you explain the glue then?
Well, they were rushing.
It just hadn't dried yet.
Yeah, apparently.
Those guys are probably dead now, by the way.
Speaking of, hey, Apple's in a little bit of trouble because there's a class action lawsuit. I don't know the merit of this, saying that the Apple iPhone AT&T exclusive is monopolistic. The point being, yeah, they always say, oh, you can terminate any time and go to another carrier, but the other carrier doesn't have the iPhone. So in reality, do we have choice?
Can't have a monopoly when you don't control the market. I mean, you can't.
It doesn't seem like it's a traditional monopoly, but there's a point. That's not a bad point. If you want an iPhone, you have to buy from AT&T. I guess it's in a way a measure of the success of the iPhone that they could even say.
But isn't that like saying, like, if you want, you know, a Dell computer, you've got to go and buy it from Dell?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, it's a vertically integrated product, right? It's not a monopoly.
Right.
It's similar to the case where people were saying it's a monopoly that Apple says you can't put OS X on other computers. You can't make a computer that runs OS X. And that doesn't fly because their market share
right.
is so minuscule
right.
that, I mean, if the iPhone were, I don't know, maybe 40% of all smartphones, let's just say it was half of all smartphones were iPhones. I think you could make a really good case.
It's not, though,
say,
is it? It's not.
No, it's not even close. I mean, it's...
In fact, with the success of Android, now Android's close to having 100,000 apps in the App Store. They're installing, according to Google, as many as 5 million new Android installations a month. That's 5 million new handsets a month. That's huge. They're doing very, very well.
they have real competition, and Microsoft is not going to is not sitting still when Windows Phone 7 comes out. I mean, that could give them even more competition. This is you have to remember, the smartphone market is a burgeoning market. It is just starting to become this huge sort of beast, you know. And so it's wide open. Apple doesn't control it. They happen to have what I consider to be the best product in that market right now, but they don't control it. And you've right. got Android devices that are...
So there's no, on the face of it, there's no merit in this lawsuit.
Although the FCC has looked askance at some of these exclusivity deals, and not just with the iPhone.
Well, I think it's consumer. Not be legal recourse, but as consumers, we can look askance at it and say, come on.
I think biggest problem is the way our industry is arranged, which is you have to buy a phone that's locked into a carrier at all. I mean, the whole idea of that, to me, seems unfair. There should be two separate
things
that happen.
You should be unlocked handset.
You buy a device,
yes.
And then
you choose a carrier. Yeah,
that's exactly right. I mean, the fact that we don't have it set up in that manner, that you have to say, if you want this device, you have to go over here.
That's why I use a Nexus One, frankly.
Hey, but you have it, it's locked to, what do you have, T-Mobile or
it's not locked, it's unlocked.
T-Mobile or AT&T bands.
Right, because GSM. Those are the two GSM carriers in the U.S., but I could take it to... the UK, and I could use it there with some other carrier. Just pop a SIM chip in.
Right, but you still have to use here in the US one of those two.
The problem in the US also is though we have very heterogeneous networks. We have GSM, we have CDMA. Even the GSM, some of the 3Gs are on different frequencies from here, from different carriers and overseas. How many companies carry the iPhone in England? Will, is it just one? Is it O2?
No, they all do.
They all do. See?
There's five different carriers in the
See?
UK,
That's
all of whom have different networks and all of whom carry the iPhone.
So
this is what
network?
Happens. I mean, I hate to tell you guys, your cellular network is the product of massive deregulation.
Yeah.
And it sucks for you.
I disagree. I think our cellular network is the product of being at the first. It's legacy. It's because we had Cellular One put in CDMA, and then GSM came along, and we had all these. And because it's old, we don't have the homogeneity of your system.
I mean, maybe that's true.
I think a lot of it's
old GSM. There's nobody's ever heard of CDMA over here, and there's also a lot of the government is pretty heavy on making sure that telephone companies give consumers good deals. I mean, they're really heavy on it. And so get the iPhone on all five
networks, and
there are different price plans, and the networks have different price points. So there's like some places you can get the iPhone cheaper, but you pay for more for the talk time.
I will grant you this. That is because we have the free market orthodoxy here, that the best way to have diversity is competition and deregulate.
No, right, which is obviously it's kind of gets back to what we were saying about ads, and if it can be gamed, then it will be gamed. If our deregulation can be gamed, then it will be gamed, and you can be sure it's being gamed right now by the carriers in this country. And the fact of the matter is we do need, every once in a while, it's not the worst thing in the world. If the government steps in and says, you know what, let's actually regulate this to make it fairer for consumers.
I got to get Brian Brushwood on here because he's the libertarian in the bunch, and he would argue with you on that one.
But look at the situation that you've got. You've got, the free market kind of scenario there where it was Apple and AT&T, or you've got over here, the hefty regulation where you can get it on five different carriers at five different price points.
Yeah.
It's kind of, QED.
Well, I'd rather have what you've got.
What's the best carrier for the iPhone?
Who do you like?
Over here?
Yeah.
O2?
Well, O2 were the guys that had it originally. And so they put quite a lot of effort into their, upgrading the capacity of their 3G network. But I hear reliable reports that Vodafone has actually got better 3G coverage overall. So if you're in a good O2 area, it's possibly better than a good Vodafone area, but you're more likely to get a good Vodafone area somewhere, across the country.
I would point out, Joshua, that we do have that situation with Android. And we were talking before the show, this is a problem for Android because there's so many handsets. Every carrier has an Android handset.
But they're different handsets. It isn't, they haven't, like, the next day.
But isn't that good? You got choice, but that confuses consumers.
Choice is good. What I'm saying is my dream is that you have the choice. You've got the Incredible, you've got the Droid X, you've got the original Droid, you've got this new Motorola Charm, whatever. You've got them all, right? But they're not carrier dependent. They're all available. They're on all carriers, or it's available as a device. And then you get the device. You say, I've got this device. Now, what carrier do
you know
I
why that's
on?
Not going to happen? Because they're going to cost $500 to $700 each.
Right.
And this goes
right.
back to that. Should we be paying more for the things that we, the gadgets that we own? Is a phone that I'm going to use for a year or 2 years, is it worth $500?
It isn't $500. It's $500 plus the $2,000 for the bandwidth.
I mean, that's a really good point, right? Because over, and this, you know, particularly relating to what we were just saying, the iPhone 4, when it came out over here, you could either buy it, you know, for £100, £200 subsidized. Attached to a network with a contract, or you could buy it direct from Apple. Apple sold it unlocked. For any carrier that you wanted, you could just walk into any carrier, you know, a retail store and just pick up a SIM card and put it straight in the iPhone. But they sold it for £600. But you had the choice. It's like that's the real cost of these things.
Oh, yeah. Well, so it isn't, though. We know the iPhone costs under $200 to make.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's the.
But
you've
got to put markup.
They have to make their money. So think about all the RD.
So mine straight from Apple and just whacked any old SIM card into it.
The truth is, so though, the cell phone companies make money like pirates. How much is $100 a month times 2 year contract?
How about a text message? Forget about that. They charge 25 cents for text message.
$1,500 a megabyte.
They charge 25 cents for a text message.
Yes,
okay?
It's $1,500 per megabyte.
The bandwidth text messages use are like a rounding error,
right.
In terms of the overall right. bandwidth that these networks right. have. I mean, that it is criminal to me that they can charge 25 cents. I mean, the fact that we don't rise up with like pitchforks and
bottom
line. Everybody has a group or a bulk text messaging. You know, you pay one fee.
Oh, yeah, $20 for 1,000 messages. That's a ripoff too.
Yeah.
$20 for 1,000 unlimited. I've got for our whole family $30 for unlimited.
You know what the bottom line is? We got it because we put up with it.
Right. Right.
That's right.
Hey, Will, I have a question for you.
You got to rise up.
I have a question for you about the iPhone and O2. When, you know, everybody is predicting that when AT&T loses its exclusivity, and let's say the iPhone goes to Verizon, that there will be a large churn at AT&T as people drop away and move over. Did that happen with O2?
You know what? Not massively. I don't know the data, but, you know, anecdotally, I think what, you know, most people who were the early adopters of the iPhone have kind of stayed with O2. I think that, from my understanding, most of the people who have picked up the iPhone on different networks have gone there because they were on that network already, or they're new users. So I think O2 hasn't seen a massive amount of people suddenly leave O2 and go to a different network because, you know, frankly, there isn't a vast amount of differentiation between the networks at all in the UK. They all have, you know, within a stone's throw, you know, the same kind of coverage and the same kind of data speeds and the same kind of, you know, price plans, which I guess is, you know, the competition of having these five guys keeps all the prices down. They're constantly, you know, coming up with better deals. So I don't think O2's lost massive amounts of people.
What carrier has the best overall coverage? If I was in Europe and I wanted to be covered everywhere I went, what would be the carrier?
Deutsche Telekom.
Yeah, Deutsche.
Deutsche Telekom, really? Yeah.
Because Deutsche owns, in total.
Including the UK.
Oh, including, yeah. So including the UK, Deutsche owns T-Mobile, which obviously is big around Europe, and Orange in the UK, which is one of the biggest in the UK.
They own Orange?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So Germans forbidden everything?
Yeah.
So that's why my next phone is going to be, I was looking at the Droid X, like the Droid X. In fact, when we come back, I want to get your guys' opinion. I like the Droid X. I'm interested, but I'm looking at the Samsung Galaxy S line, and I think that the T-Mobile one is the one I'm going to get because it's a GSM. I can take it out of the Nexus one. I can put it in there, and I can go around the world. We'll do that in just a second. We'll talk about that. And Google and China agree on a fiction. What is going on in China? We'll get the details in just a bit before we do, though. Time to talk about audiobooks. Who here listens to audiobooks? Anybody in the panel? Audible? Oh, everybody in the audience and Will Harris. You don't have Audible in the UK, do you?
Yes, we do.
You do?
Contrary to popular opinion, we have these modern kind of technologies, books that can be read over audio devices.
You have audiobooks?
Incredible.
Wow. I say, what a good idea. Actually, some of the best audiobooks are from the UK. Stephen Fry reading the Harry Potter books is
exactly
to die for. John Lee? Who's John Lee?
He's one of the readers.
One of the readers for Harry Potter or?
No, for Audible.
Audible. Count of Monte. Okay, I'm getting a recommendation right now from our live studio audience for The Count of Monte Cristo. We're talking about Audible.com. Audible is your audio bookstore. 75,000. Actually, that's got a date. I'm sure it's now 80 or 90,000. It's growing all the time because Audible's recording new books all the time, and they're getting them from all the best audiobook creators, the best readers with the best fiction. There's not a title out there that you nowadays you almost always can guarantee you're going to be able to get all the bestsellers at Audible.com. I'm a huge Audible fan. I think anybody who listens to this show knows by now this is Audible and me go together like grilled cheese and tomato soup. Count of Monte Cristo. You know why I'm thinking of that? Because of a Monte Cristo sandwich. That's what you got me going on that one. Let's see. And you say that the one, well, now there's one narrated by Orson Welles. Can't speak to that one. Yeah, that's going to be good. But you think the John Lee, now this is the unabridged, because the Orson Welles is 51 minutes. Orson's very expensive. If you get the unabridged Count of Monte Cristo, one of the great books of all time, by the way, which I loved, The Man in the Iron Mask. Oh, I love this book. 47 hours. This is going to last you, and you can get it free. In fact, you can get two books free if you go to audible.com/twit2. I'll tell you what, get that and The Three Musketeers. No? The Three Musketeers, terrible? Oh, wow, I'm getting some reviews here. Okay, how about, you know what, my favorite, Les Misérables. How about that one? Will we go with that one? That's Victor Hugo. These came out at the same time. These are some great books you can listen to where you'll be swept away. Les Misérables, 57 hours. So we just gave you 100 hours for free of great Audible entertainment. Audible.com/twit2. But let me tell you, you can read that, of course, the classics. But they've also got brand new bestsellers. Look at the New York Times bestseller list. If you go to audible.com, you see so many great books. I'm reading The Help right now. I'm loving it. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, just finished that. Moving on to The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, part of the Millennium series. McMafia, another. Do you like John Lee a lot, huh? All right. We've got a couple of listeners in the studio today who are obviously Audible fans. This is one of the things that happens with Audible people when they get together. They start talking about, oh you got to hear this. Oh, this is a good one. McMafia, a journal through the global criminal underworld. This is nonfiction. All right, I want to hear what John Lee sounds like. This is another great thing about Audible. You can get previews of any books on the website.
Apartment block a stone's throw from Sherlock Holmes's reputed domicile at 221B Baker Street in central
London. All right, Will, where's this guy come from?
Had found a flat. At some point, relations between the Armenian and the Chechens soured. Later,
it's a little BBC, isn't it? It's kind of a BBC.
Well, that's, isn't that,
it's John Lee.
What was the name of the narrator?
John Lee.
Oh.
Who's that?
Sounds bizarrely like a really famous actor off Love Actually.
Oh. Hugh Grant you're thinking of.
No.
Oh, I know who you're talking about.
The older one.
Yeah.
What the heck is that guy's name?
So do you just listen to John Lee?
No.
You don't like...
Hugh Grant would be great, though, wouldn't he?
Who?
To read. Hugh Grant would be a great... I'd listen to
he
that.
He would be. He'd be awesome.
They should have Hugh an... Grant. Okay, I'm going to go tell the Audible folks. You need a section of guys with poncy British accents.
Bill Nighy is the guy you're thinking
Bill
of.
Bill Nighy! I love him. You know, he was great in Pirate Radio. He is so good. I love him.
Audible, go and get Bill Nighy.
Maybe they have him. B-I-L-L-N-I-G-H-E. Is that how you spell it?
G-H-Y.
G-H-Y. Nighy. Maybe they have them. You can search for them. I'll tell you what. Here's what you do. You go to audible.com/twit2. Oh, listen to this. Oh, Radio Crimes, a Charles Paris mystery, The Dead Side of the Mic. This is Bill Nighy and Suzanne Burden.
Hello, Charles Paris Escort Agency, leatherwearer speciality.
What if it happened in me?
You've got your own ringtone plus a foxy little Francis on the screen.
I'm not fucking vampire.
Well, yeah, I don't think that's a book.
Yes, it is.
Phone sex conversation between two people.
Okay. If you're a Bill Nighy fan, this is a great book, which I did read. Eric Clapton's autobiography, narrated by Bill Nighy. You got to love that.
Nice. Talk about conflation of awesome worlds.
So when she found out she was pregnant, she had to cope on her own. Rose and Jack protected her and I was born secretly in the upstairs back bedroom of their house on the 30th of March, 1945.
And this is, by the way, one of the great rock and roll biographies. Really enjoyed it.
You kind of want to hear Clapton reading it, though, don't you? It's written first
yeah.
person.
Yeah. Well, you know, they probably couldn't get Eric to sit still for that long.
You know, he can sing. He can probably read.
Oh, he'd be good.
So,
all right, we're going to lobby for that, too. So Bill Nye's got 6 books on Audible.com. So there you go.
Excellent.
Audible.com/twit2. See, here's the problem. Picking two. Audible plays on everything. Your iPhone, Android now has the best Audible application. Oh, it's so good. You can download any of your Audible books directly onto the phone. This is something the iPhone needs desperately. I hope they do one for the iPhone. It also, many GPS devices, almost all the MP3 players, Kindles. I mean, I could, you know, 500 different devices. You can listen to your books wherever you are, at the gym, at work, on a commute. I listen while I'm doing the shows, to be honest with you. I'm not paying any attention. I'm listening to an Audible book. Audible.com/twit2. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. I think this is probably, I probably buried the lead on this, the big story of the week, which is that Google, which is about to lose its license in China, its internet content provider license, decided to stop redirecting Google searches at google.cn to Hong Kong. So that they can get their license renewed, this is weird stuff they're doing. They, in fact, did get their license renewed on Friday because here's what they're doing. Google has replaced the search box on google.cn with a picture of a search box. When you click it, so it's not, it's, you can't type any, no field, it's just an image. When you click on it, it takes you to google.hk. And apparently, this was about face saving because the Chinese authorities said, okay, that's all we care about. So Google's still in China, still redirecting, but you can't fill out a form. You have to click a link. I think the real issue is that Google is something that the Chinese elites weren't really willing to give up. And so that's why they blinked. What do you think, guys? Dwight, you have any thought about this?
Well, the thing with the image is weird. I don't quite understand why that would mollify the Chinese.
Because they wanted to be mollified.
I guess so. Oh, yeah, you put that there. And it's not a, I guess because you're not actually typing in a search at google.cn that then goes to Google HK. You're clicking on, I guess, a portal that takes you there. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's probably a cultural thing, I suspect. But the headline on there, they agree to a fiction, I think is apt.
Remember, this is the country that invented diplomacy. I mean, this is they've got ways and ways around this thing.
I'm glad to see that Google is at least kind of doing what it can to stand up for what it originally said it was going to do. Yeah. You know, they could have caved in order to keep that license, and they found a way to continue to offer unfiltered searches. And good for them. I suspect the people in China who wanted to get unfiltered searches could have gotten them anyway.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult to know what Google's – I mean, Google's motivations, their outward motivations are to they don't want their search results censored, but I'm not sure that I mean, I don't think this is the only situation where the search results are being censored. I mean, it may be a little more extreme than other places, but Google, obviously, each localized search is going to have, you know, that region's idiosyncrasies. I mean, I don't believe that they're just straight up unfiltered search everywhere in the world. I mean, I can't tell if there's another business reason here why Google is doing this, or is this purely
they want to stay in China?
Altruistic?
No, they want to stay in China.
I mean, of course they want to stay in China. I mean, they're not winning in the search market race there.
No.
They're being beat pretty badly. But I don't know if it's just pure altruism that they just want to bring freedom to the Chinese and their searches.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you followed this, that Eric Schmidt didn't want to abandon the market, wanted to give in to Chinese authorities and follow Chinese law. And that Larry Page was the purist who said, no, we can't do that. That violates our deeply held beliefs. I don't want to be in China if we have to filter our search results. And that what's happened is both sides have found a compromise that lets them not lose face, but kind of win the point. I think in a way that you'd have to say the Chinese government is the one that gave in on this. I mean, you still can search. You have unfiltered search in China now via Google.
Do they give in, or have they reached just a really face-saving? Like you said,
face-saving.
It's kind of like, you know.
Here's what
I mean. How much do they care? I think is the question. The Chinese government.
I think you're right. Baidu, the Chinese search engine, is huge, much bigger than Google,
which I'm sure is under complete control.
Of course, it is.
By the government,
completely censored. But the Chinese elites, and I think this is not to be ignored, used Google and wanted Google. So the Chinese government said, well, look, as long as the people don't find Falun Gong in their search results, they keep using Baidu, we want to keep our elites happy too. And so this, I think this is a way of mollifying the elites by letting Google stay in China. That's who uses Google in China, is the intellectuals.
The idea of elites in a communist country is...
Oh, there are elites. Well, it's really not a communist country.
The whole idea of communism to eliminate elitism.
It's a very capitalistic country. It really, yeah.
It's the worst of both worlds, isn't it?
I don't know.
The worst part of communism mixed with, which is like a fascist dictatorship, mixed with the worst part of capitalism, which is unbridled...
greed.
You know, unbridled greed at the expense of any human life. I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of hate mail.
And J.C. Wayne's pointing out in the chat room, this is true, that there still is the Great Firewall of China. So you could find Falun Gong pages, references, but then to click on that page, you won't necessarily be able to get it. So the search results are unfiltered. Google is returning information unfettered, but China still controls what pages you get to see.
So are we about to have another China in Australia?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Australian government has for a long time been really trying to filter search results or pages. In fact, they now demand, is this the law now that they demand that ISPs block certain sites?
What sites are they blocking?
I don't know that they've, I'm not sure that they actually have, I think that law is percolating. I'm not sure it's necessarily in place.
It's not in place yet. The Perth boy, who I presume is in Australia.
Yeah.
Says
yeah,
not
I don't think
yet.
That's in place. And there's a lot of opposition to it. But
well, this is the same country that proposed that filters be put on all computers. And then, of course, the filter was immediately broken by people.
Yeah. I was going to say, in Australia, the sort of the governing party there has said they want to roll this out, and they've said that since 2008, but as of yet, they haven't yet done it.
Current status, according to Perth Boy and our other Australians, and we have quite a few in the chat room, is that the law has been put on hold for a year.
It was a really interesting... I mean, the comprehensive is wikipedia.org/internet censorship in Australia.
There you go. It's all there.
What was the goal here? What were they trying to? I've missed this.
Think of the children.
Yeah, exactly. I think you
porn?
Have.
They're trying to censor
child porn. Yep. I think you have a very reactionary wing of the Australian Parliament or government or whatever they call it. That is really scared of the internet and really does want to filter it. And I think that you also have, there are a lot of cooler heads, including, I understand, most of the ISPs in Australia who hate this idea. They don't want to have anything to do with it. Facebook, according to Inside Facebook, Facebook's June U.S. traffic did not grow so good. Facebook's growth slowed in the U.S., only 320,000 new monthly users in June compared to, get ready, 7.8 million the month before. Not only didn't grow, it crashed. Now the question
is dead.
Yeah, I think it's over. So let's call
it.
We're going to call it 4:50 p.m. on June 11th. What's going to be hot?
It's a good thing that Google Me is
hot.
Stepping in to take the place of.
So here's the question, and I think they debated this on TNT earlier. We have a great daily news show now, by the way. Everybody should listen to it with Tom Merritt, Becky Worley, Sarah Lane, Dr. Kiki, and many others. And that's every weekday afternoon, 2:30 to 3:30 on live.twit.tv Pacific. That's 5:30 to 6:30 Eastern. But they debated this earlier. And the real question is it that Facebook's saturated? Like everybody in the world is already a member, so you're not going to grow as fast. Or people are reacting to the privacy issue. I have to think the former, right? That it's just saturated.
People are not reacting. I mean, there are a few people who are reacting to the privacy issue. Most people are barely aware of the privacy issue. I think the fact is that, you know, in the sort of the markets that Facebook has launched into, the sort of, you know, primarily Western markets, they are pretty much saturated. I mean, who do you know who's online that doesn't really have a Facebook account? The major growth, I think, and I think Mark Zuckerberg said this at a conference a few weeks ago, is going to come for Facebook in developing nations. And that's how they're going to get to a billion users. But they do say that, you know, Zuckerberg said that a billion users is inevitable for Facebook. They're
the place where Facebook needs to break through is the place where Farmville needs to be played is the places where people are actually farming a lot in real life.
No, I think that would cause a collapse of the food chain and we would all die.
I agree that it's a question of saturation. I mean, they don't have everybody, but they've got a lot of people. And when you balloon to a certain point and then you have to hang out there a little bit, you know, and I think that I don't think the privacy issue is real to a lot of people. I think we might have talked about this on the last show that I think that it's a small group of people. I mean, how successful was the Quit Facebook Day? Not very successful.
I think 30,000 or 40,000 people quit. Not a huge.
That's
number.
Probably about how many people are really upset over the privacy issues then, or even aware of them.
Right. I think you're right. So saturation. We vote for saturation.
Or it's dead. Or it's totally dead. Yeah.
I think it would have a chance of being dead if there were an alternative, but there just isn't. And this is where the network effect is so hard to overcome. You know, when you've got a billion people, or in this case, half a billion people using something, it's pretty hard to get them to move all at once to somewhere else.
Now, there's a monopoly. You want to sue somebody for monopoly? Yeah. You can start Facebook. So they monopolize the social networking space online, and it's simply impossible to break into it.
Now, these same kind of things were said about AOL when AOL was at its peak.
That's right. Cannot be killed.
Right. And AOL, to me, Facebook is AOL. I mean, I've seen this movie before. And the difference is that AOL had a fixed distribution system, kind of like newspapers, where they connected and got to people through dial-up modems, and they weren't able to make the leap to broadband, and that's kind of what killed them. At some point, there could be something that Facebook basically just doesn't deal with well, right, that could take it offline.
It's gonna have to be something like that. Mm-hmm. So, do you guys, any of you, play StarCraft rather?
Back in the day,
loved that game.
Yeah,
StarCraft 2 is out.
LAN parties with StarCraft.
I've always had the sensation when you play online with people, not like LAN parties, like your friends, fine, but when you play against strangers on the internet, that there are just some people who live in a different world from you and me. And now I know it for sure. This is from a documentary called The Hack's Life. Got this from Ars Technica. They call it actions per minute. To be a truly good StarCraft player, or I guess any game like this, you have to be able to click 200 actions a minute.
My God.
Look at this guy.
This is not right.
This is a top class. This is not sped up. This is in real time, a top class Korean player. He is playing StarCraft 2, and he is up to 200 actions per minute. He said it's an average rate of how quickly your fingers move. To win a championship, it should be at least over 200 and in the low 300s per minute. And you've got to see this video, because as he's clicking... I don't know how he's thinking. I can see how you could click that fast, but I don't know how you can think that fast. He says he puts sandbags under his wrists to speed up his speed. You got to watch this guy. Look at this guy.
Wow.
When he's not doing this, he's pushing out iPhone 4s.
When he's not doing this, he's not doing anything. I think this is all this guy does ever.
He's a professional player.
I guess so. He doesn't even, apparently, doesn't even cut his nails. I don't think he has time. Look at this.
No, he probably needs longer nails since he has to reach less far to the keys.
So if you've ever played StarCraft and you wonder, why do I keep getting my ass handed to me? It's because of this.
Is this part of this money-making scheme?
No, this isn't gold. This isn't gold. What do they call that? Gold digging, gold. No, it's not grinding. Gold digging, but this is just this guy.
He just likes it.
Likes it. Likes to play. He's a
champion.
I used
to be a pretty avid Quake 3 arena player. I was horrible. I had my online name was the Llama King, and there was a reason for that. But what I would do is I would go to like QuakeCon, and I would play just for the experience, I'd play against, you know, some of these like Fatality and so forth as part of the press tournament. And it was just astonishing to what these guys could do. I couldn't fathom either watching them, standing behind them, or playing against them, how they did what they do. It just doesn't seem human.
Yeah.
It's like Ender's Game. It's like they're, you know, their brain is plugged into that environment in a way. I mean, I like playing FPSs. I mean, you know, every once in a while I'll play a multiplayer, you know, deathmatch. We played a couple of years ago at CES. We had a few nights where we, late at night, we had some unreal matches with the whole team, the whole Engadget team.
So that's fun. If you're playing with friends, because they're
And we were all in the same room, so it was like 25 people in the same room playing, which was an enormous amount of fun. But I was surprised because I had played it before and had not played it for a long time. And it comes back to you, you know, it's like kind of like riding a bike. It's this weird memory. It's like you get in there and then you can do it. But they're operating. I mean, the guys who do that professionally are operating on a level that is just completely. I mean, the government should be talking to those guys.
I'm sure they are.
Drones or something.
They're running the Predators. I'm sure it's the same guys in the basement in Las Vegas.
It probably is.
It's pretty impressive. But that's why, you know, just so you know, that's why it's so hard when you play online with real people. We used to do a LAN party at the Screensavers. In fact, it was so much fun. We'd play Halo. It was so much fun that sometimes we'd be coming back from the commercial and it'd be like, no, wait. Because you just don't want to stop. It really is. It really is a lot of fun.
Makes me want to have a LAN party.
I know. Well, one of the things I've wanted to do, and we will do this, Ryan Brushwood runs a Team Fortress clan. But I think we will do this. If anybody listening can do this, I would like a level of some game. Could be any game. Could be Quake, Quake 3. I would like a level of the Twit Cottage. We'll send you plans. We'll send you pictures. Make a level.
Oh, I'm there.
Wouldn't that be
so
fun?
There.
Make a level. And then we had a Screensaver set level of Unreal. So make a level, and then we'll host a big LAN party after Twit every week.
I'm into that.
Wouldn't that be
Quake
fun?
3?
Yes, that would
Quake
be great.
3 would
Quake
be good.
Arena. Yeah, that's good.
That'd be a good one.
All right.
It's kind of the lowest common denominator game now.
Yeah, well, anybody who's got the skills. Look, if you're the designer, you get to choose the game. But we'll send you anything you need, all the schematics. Actually, it'd be a good thing because we don't know what the hell's going on in here anyway. We probably should make some schematics. Joshua Topolsky, so nice to have you. Editor-in-chief of Engadget, Engadget.com.
Great to be here.
A must read. The Engadget podcast is every week, right?
Every week. We do it usually on Thursday or Friday. We put up a post and let people know. And then we do the Engadget show once a month. It's a live event here in New York, and we'll be doing one pretty soon.
We'd love to get you back on the Twit Network doing that, too. It was really fun when we broadcast. Simulcast, I guess, your Engadget podcast. Engadget.com. Dwight Silverman is the tech blogger at the Houston Chronicle, blogs.cron.com/techblog. A must-read every day, and his link roll is especially useful. He also hosts Technology Bites, one of, what, like just 12 hosts or something on that show.
I think there's 6 of us.
It's a lot of people.
Yes, it sounds like a bunch of guys sitting around making fun of people with computer problems for 2 hours. It's a lot of fun.
It's really a great show. If you're in the Houston area, you must. Is it on all of Pacifica or just Houston?
It's just on KPFT, but you can get the podcast at geekradio.com. It's the podcast goes up the next morning, kind of the way Twit does, and you can listen to it. It's also on iTunes.
Excellent.
It's called Technology Bites.
So great to see you again, Will Harris. I know it's very late. Did you stay up and watch? We won't say anything, but you stayed up and watched the game. Uh-oh, I can't hear you. I potted you down. I'm sorry. Have you been trying to talk this whole time, Will?
I'm always trying to talk.
I accidentally nice turned you on. Poor Will. No wonder you're sitting there with your head in your hands. I'm so sorry. I had you potted down. I apologize.
Fail. Level fail.
I thought it was the Vuvuzela mic I was turning off.
This was the one place I thought I could escape from that sound.
Never.
I saw somebody did with the Vuvuzela. They did like a layering of them at different pitches. So it started off with like the ba, ba, ba. And of course you get the ba, ba.
Yeah,
which is like perfect.
Will is the guy who runs a great network out of the UK called Channel Flip, channelflip.com. Not just technology video on all sorts of subjects. It's really, I think, the future of IPTV. And I know you're doing very well. So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And always a pleasure. You can go to bed now. What time is it? 4?
It's 1 in the morning.
Oh, that's not so bad.
And I got to go to work tomorrow.
Oh, well, just blame me. Tell them to blame me. Tell them it was the vuvuzelas that kept you up.
Something like
that. One thing we know, that it wasn't the late night celebrations of the England victory in the World Cup.
Oh, just leave it out.
I was rooting for you right till the second round.
Nobody else was rooting for us over here. Yeah.
But it is the land of football. We know that. Well, it's great to talk to you. We'll get you back very soon. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We are going to Detroit. I wanted to give you a program note. July 31st, which is a Friday, we're going to be broadcasting live via our Live U backpack that lets us broadcast live anywhere. I understand we're going to get a tour of Dearborn and the assembly lines. We're going to see how a modern car is built. Ford's going to take us there to the Ford plant. We can actually go and look at the assembly line stuff. I can't wait for that. And then the day after, Maker Faire Detroit, we're going to be bringing you live coverage, visit some of the booths. It'll be our traditional kind of crazy conference coverage where we become your eyes and ears at a trade show. So that'll be a lot of fun. That's August 1st in Detroit. And we do have some other exciting events coming up. I know Tom Merritt's going to be at Comic-Con. We're going to send Tom and a bunch of other folks to Dragon-Con in September. And, of course, our coverage of CES is going to be even better than ever in January. We're working on this because we want to do more live stuff for you. Don't forget TNT every Monday through Friday. Tech News Today with Tom Merritt and his great co-hosts. 2:30 to 3:30 Pacific. That's 5:30 to 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time at live.twit.tv. Tom Merritt's coming up next with East Meets West. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. Another
this
twit
is in the can.
Hey. Doing the twit, baby. Doing the twit, baby. All right. Doing the twit, baby.